Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for listening. I hope that you're home and warm and safe after the past couple of days we've had out in the Atlanta weather. It's amazing how 1 inch can just wreak havoc on a city that's not used to snow. But we're thankful that you're here today, and our topic is demystifying colonoscopies. Excluding skin cancer, colorectal cancer is the third most common kind of cancer in the United States and one of the leading causes of cancer-related deaths. And in general, the CDC reported in my research that in November of 2013, 20 million Americans still have not completed a colon cancer screening test. So I have with me an expert today that's going to talk about this screening test and other things that colonoscopies are used for. Let me introduce you to Dr. Max Shapiro. Welcome, Dr. Shapiro.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Great. And let me tell you a little bit about him. We've been chatting about the snow in Boston. He's originally from Boston, got his medical degree from Tufts University, and then made his way south here to Atlanta to complete his residency in internal medicine from Emory University. And then he went on to do a fellowship in gastroenterology and hepatology at Georgetown University and ended back up here in Atlanta. He has special interest in colon cancer screening, and right now he's in private practice at Metro Atlanta Gastroenterology at St. Joe's. So welcome.
Thank you.
So tell me how you ended up in gastroenterology, because you actually took the time and probably 2 or 3 years extra to kind of get trained in that specialty. So what was kind of your journey there?
So it started out in medical school. I did a rotation in gastroenterology as part of my internal medicine rotation, and I just pretty much liked it right away. Mostly there was a variety in the way that I could help people, or that the doctors I was with were helping people, both including infectious diseases like hepatitis C and B, intestinal infections, with chronic inflammatory diseases like Crohn's and colitis, upper GI, lower GI diseases, liver disease, and pancreas and biliary tract, as well as colon and other GI cancers, including cancer prevention, which we're talking about today in the form of screening.
And way easier to not deal with all that and take care of yourself up front. But people are still pretty resistant. Would you agree with the CDC finding that still not enough people are getting screened?
Yes. I mean, obviously I'm biased by the people that I see that are here, that are seeing me to be screened. Mm-hmm. So all those people that are out there not being screened are not coming my way, but I'm sure that's the case, that there are a lot of people that are reluctant for a variety of reasons, and hopefully today will change a few minds.
That's hopefully so. So let's just jump right in there. What are some of the main reasons? Fear of probably the procedure, or I know technology has changed quite a bit. We're actually going to talk a little bit about the specifics of the procedure, but what are some of the other things? Do you think it's them not knowing the baseline? Do you think it's people just not being familiar with the procedure? What do you think are some of the barriers to screening?
Yeah, I think it's kind of all of the above. To think about the procedure, it is an invasive procedure. Mm-hmm. It doesn't involve an area of the body that a lot of people are not comfortable with doctors being around. And then people do have issues, mostly from, I think, stories that they've heard from friends and family members, a lot of times involving the preparation, getting the colon cleared out to get the best test, as well as, I think, less so the procedure itself, but occasionally people will hear that a friend of a friend had a major complication and they don't want that to happen to them. It's sort of these horror stories that get circulated around, and I think
those are some primary reasons.
Sums it up.
Now, what is your opinion? I know that with the Affordable Care Act, we saw the president on TV at the State of the Union the other night. We're talking a lot more in healthcare about prevention these days instead of just dealing with the disease once you have it. Do you think that I know a lot more screening, not just for colonoscopies, but for breast health and pap smears and all kinds of things are being included with these baseline packages. Do you think that the screening will go up or down, or what's your opinion on that?
Well, in all likelihood, will go up. As you mentioned, screening, including colon cancer screening, colonoscopy is considered in the preventive health services under the Affordable Care Act. So most people, either with a traditional private insurance plan or with one of the new exchange plans, will have coverage of the procedure or other colon cancer screening tests, usually covered at 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So usually there's no copay or coinsurance unless they were grandfathered into an older plan.
Okay.
So
this should be pretty
good
coverage.
Given the benefits and the lower barriers, and I guess cost could have been a barrier, one that we didn't talk about before. But with that barrier essentially gone, hopefully more people will get on the bandwagon.
Now, in general, even with screening kind of lagging behind what I guess is recommended for the population and the recommendations, which we'll get into, is colon cancer itself going up or down in terms of its prevalence and incidence in the U.S.?
It actually is going down.
That's what I heard.
So in large part due to ramped up screening programs. Mm-hmm.
So catching it earlier.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the unique things about colon cancer actually is not catching it earlier, but catching it when it's still not cancer, when it's a polyp, which is a growth in the colon that is benign, but if left alone does have the potential to grow large, transform, and turn into cancer. So that's one place that colon cancer screening is unique. Not only are you catching cancer potentially at a very early stage like you would with a breast cancer and a mammogram, but you're actually catching it before it's cancer and in that way truly preventing the disease, not just catching it early, which would lead to a better outcome.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking right up front in the show about colon cancer screening, but I know colonoscopies is the main way that we test, and we'll talk about that procedure. But what are the other indications for a colonoscopy besides colon cancer screening?
Yeah, so we divide colonoscopy into screening, which we've touched on, and the other part of it is diagnostic. In other words, to look for a specific cause of a problem. And certainly one of the most common is blood in the stool.
Mm-hmm.
Often it is blood that's visualized. But also it can be detected in microscopic form, what we call occult blood testing with a stool card. Iron deficiency anemia and other kinds of anemia do come up. The colon is one of the most common places, and colon cancer specifically, that can lead to severe iron deficiency from chronic slow blood loss. So if someone is detected to have anemia and iron deficiency, colonoscopy is recommended to at least rule out colon cancer as the source. Other types of change in bowel habits, slower bowel movements, in other words, more constipation or diarrhea, change in stool form, where people see small caliber stool. There's a variety of reasons for those changes, usually not colon cancer, but other kinds of diseases can be detected on colonoscopy, depending on the condition. Certain forms of abdominal pain can be a sign of a more serious colon condition that could be found on colonoscopy. And then the final one we see is sometimes people have a CAT scan or X-ray or other kind of imaging test that may detect a possible polyp or other abnormality in the colon, and then the colonoscopy can be used to actually visualize the colon. Was that a real finding? And was there really a polyp or a mass there? Or was it some sort of artifact from the imaging test?
Mm-hmm. So to verify, again, diagnostic, rule in or rule out.
Exactly.
Okay, sounds good. Well, let's kind of get into some screening recommendations. So what are the standards at which we should get colon cancer colonoscopy screening done?
So for the general average risk population, it starts for both men and women at age 50.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we start to see a rise in the general population of colon polyps, mostly, and a few early colon cancers. it's a relatively arbitrary number, so we're really trying to get people in their early 50s.
Is that because it's slow growing? Like, are those polyps slow growing?
They are.
Okay.
Usually takes over 10 years for a early polyp to develop, grow, transform, and turn into cancer. So if a person is 53 or 54, they haven't missed the boat, that's another perfect time to get in and get screened. There are other risk factors, mainly family history, that would prompt an earlier colonoscopy, especially if it's a person has a first-degree family member who was diagnosed with colon cancer at any age, really, but especially if they've been diagnosed under the age of 60. Usually we start those patients at age 40 or 10 years before their family member was diagnosed.
Is there any kind of genetic link, like we're learning about the genes for breast cancer? Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like the Angelina Jolie preventatively, is there anything like that with the colon cancer?
Yes, there are several colon cancer genetic syndromes. That's the minority of colon cancer that we see. But even the family history that I mentioned with a first-degree family member, mm-hmm. it would double or possibly triple the person's risk. Mm-hmm. So going from about a 5% lifetime risk for the average person, possibly up to a 10 or 15% mm-hmm. risk.
And then what would the recommendation be on how early, instead of 50, when would you, if you had that kind of a history, when would they you start doing screening?
Usually at age 40, 10 okay. years, or if the family member was actually diagnosed in their 40s, it would be starting 10 years before they were diagnosed. So if the family member were diagnosed at age 45, you'd start the patient at age 35.
Okay. And what about, do you see gender or ethnicity differences as far as when they should get their baseline?
So right now for gender, even though men do have a slightly higher risk of colon cancer and polyps than women, there are no differences in the recommendations.
Okay.
There has been some data over the past several years that suggest African American patients may develop colon cancer earlier or may have more rapidly progressing forms. So some societies recommend starting at age 45 mm-hmm. For African Americans, but not all the insurance plans have adapted to that. So in order to be covered for that as a routine screening test, any individual will have to check with a particular insurance plan to see if it would be covered.
Okay.
But I encourage my African American patients to start at age 45.
Okay. And then once we get our screening done, mm-hmm. what percent, like of the people that you screen, what percent do you actually find something?
So the national
needs to be followed.
The national data suggests that about 15% of women and 25% of men at age 50 will have a polyp, a benign polyp, and the numbers may be a little bit higher because as the technology and colon preparation, et cetera, improves mm-hmm. over the years, mm-hmm. those numbers may actually go up. But right now, those are sort of the benchmarks mm-hmm. of what we expect and what we tell patients to anticipate.
Okay. And then once we have that baseline colonoscopy, how often do you recommend we come back?
That depends on the finding.
Okay.
With a standard average risk mm-hmm. person that comes in at age 50 and has a completely normal colonoscopy meeting, some of the benchmark standards that we look at would not necessarily need to have another one for up to 10 years.
Okay.
So that's the low risk group. And like I mentioned, we think even if they developed a small polyp the next day after the colonoscopy, mm-hmm. it would take over 10 years for that to become a large polyp and turn to cancer. So the 10 years, it should be a safe window. Of course, if they develop symptoms or other
right.
things in the
then
meantime,
then there would be an indication to
correct.
Speed it up. Okay.
But patients that do have polyps identified usually have a 5-year follow-up, sometimes 3 years if they're large polyps or have certain higher risk features or many polyps. The higher risk people based on family history may need it every 5 years, even with a normal colonoscopy at baseline.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds great. Now, let's actually demystify this procedure that people are afraid of and start with the prep. So okay. you mentioned there's kind of the old things or people may have heard stories, and then bring us up to date on what is the typical prep that people – a lot of people say the prep is worse than the procedure.
Almost everyone says the prep is worse than the procedure, and it's usually true. The prep, any way you kind of slice it, the goal is to clean out the colon mm-hmm. out
so
of the stool.
See.
So it's going to be, no matter what you do, it's mm-hmm. going to produce a lot of large volume bowel movements.
Mm-hmm.
And The standard, like you mentioned, used to be about a gallon jug of liquid laxative the night mm-hmm. before. That jug is still available. It's 4 liters. And the way that it's being given more commonly because of a better result is actually in split dosing. So instead of drinking the whole thing the night before, it would be split to some the night before and some the morning of, which does make it a little bit easier to tolerate that high volume. Mm-hmm. But also there's several newer, smaller volume preps that are now on the market mm-hmm. that are a lot easier to drink, a lot less volume, and also given in the split dose format.
Okay. So you get the same result, but you don't have the massive drinking. You're going to have the same result, but it won't be as bad going.
You won't be drinking as much of the disgusting tasting laxative. Mm-hmm. That's the bottom
line. Can they make that taste better? That is disgusting. I've had my colonoscopy, and that stuff is bad.
And some of the newer ones are. More palatable.
Okay.
I don't think any of them are pleasant, but the newer ones are definitely easier to tolerate.
Okay. So the patient actually, what about diet before, diet prep?
Yeah. And again, I would encourage anyone to talk specifically about their own prep and their diet recommendations, et cetera, with uh-huh. their own physician. But generally speaking, at least part of the day before the test would involve a clear liquid diet okay. so that you wouldn't be forming new solid stool mm-hmm. that would need to be then cleaned out.
Mm-hmm. So you'd start the morning before when you wake up probably with clear liquids, and then you'd start your prep depending upon what your doctor orders, some the day before and maybe carrying over to the next day.
Correct.
Okay. Are most of these procedures done in an outpatient setting or in the hospital these days?
Most of them are in the outpatient setting. Okay. There's several what they call ambulatory surgery centers mm-hmm. or endoscopy suites where it can be done somewhat more efficiently and with less cost mm-hmm. Than in the hospital setting. Mm-hmm. Some patients that have other medical conditions, et cetera, would require to be done.
Closely monitored or
exactly.
just in case?
Just in case. But most people can be safely have their procedure done in an outpatient setting.
Okay. That sounds good. So that makes it way easier both in terms of cost and probably recovery and the whole experience, not having to go through admissions and everything in a hospital.
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about what happens for the procedure themselves. The patient comes to the endoscopy center or the hospital, mm-hmm. and then what can they expect? What will happen to them?
So at this point, there's probably going to be a somewhat of a fork in the road where, depending on what kind of sedation is chosen, mm-hmm. The two main kinds that we use these days are one with anesthesia that delivers a medicine, usually propofol, where the patient is completely sedated and is completely asleep and really is not aware of anything that's going on. And again, that does require an anesthesia provider mm-hmm. to administer that. And the other way is what we call conscious sedation or twilight sedation, where the patient is very sleepy, relaxed, comfortable. They may be aware of some things that are going on, but
they're happy about it.
But
they're
don't care
be upset
as much,
about
and,
it, right.
and the, any pain or discomfort really has the edge is taken off by those medicines. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that would be up to the up to the individual provider what they recommend for the individual patient and their practice standards.
Okay, so the patient checks in; they're going to have either conscious sedation or be totally out, and then they start an IV.
So the IV, it started first. The both of those kinds of medications are delivered through mm-hmm. the IV. So once the medicine is on board and the procedure is cleared to start, a small flexible camera tube is inserted into the rectum mm-hmm. and advanced all the way around the colon until it meets the appendix and the connection to the small intestine. Mm-hmm. And those are the two landmarks most commonly used to identify a complete colonoscopy. Mm-hmm.
And then you just start looking and taking pictures and looking for polyps.
Exactly. Now, so the main goal on the way pushing the camera in is to get to those landmarks. And okay. most of the careful exam is done actually on what's called the withdrawal, bringing the camera out. So the idea is to look at closely at all the walls of the colon, clear away any residual stool that still may be there. That way small and flat polyps can be detected. And perhaps your next question is if the polyp is found.
Exactly. Can you do anything there while you're there?
So the vast majority of the polyps can be removed at the time of the colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. If there's a very large or high-risk polyp, it may need to be removed with a surgery at a separate time, but the vast majority will be taken out by the person performing the colonoscopy at the time of the colonoscopy using a couple of different instruments.
So what would be large? Like how would you measure that? What's the break point?
Usually, most polyps that are identified are going to be less than a centimeter.
Okay.
The ones that are larger than a centimeter are somewhat more high risk and probably would require the patient to come back for a closer follow-up. Those usually can be safely removed as well. The larger ones, once we start talking about 2 and 3 centimeters, especially if they're flat and covering a lot of surface area, have much higher risk of complications if they're removed at the time of the colonoscopy and they may need a separate evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Now, so can you tell by looking at the kind and the measurements of the polyp precancerous, or you have to send it out for pathology, of course, anyway, but like, can you get a pretty good visual on?
We can pretty well tell for the vast majority of polyps if there are these very small benign appearing polyps. Mm-hmm. Or they start to be larger and potentially could have early cancers detected inside the polyp. Usually if it's a cancer that's already has spread into the rest of the wall of the colon, we can tell that. And again, okay. Those have certain features.
So it'll be invasive into the colon wall.
And those have certain features where they would not be removed at the time of the colonoscopy. And then as far as some of the small benign polyps are what's called hyperplastic polyps, which do not generally have precancerous potential, though there are certain features that may still recommend a closer follow-up. And then the other kind are called adenomas, which are still benign, but these are thought to have a potential to turn into cancer. Not all will, and certainly the one that was found will not because it was taken out. But if those are present, that does increase the risk, which is why we recommend a 3 or 5 year follow-up if one of those are identified.
Okay. All right. So the follow-up will be determined by what you actually find.
Correct.
and how extensive it is.
And it may have to wait until that final pathology comes back from the separate pathology report.
Okay. And how long does this procedure take?
The procedure itself usually takes about 20 or 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. The rest of the time spent in the office may be up to an hour and a half, 2 hours, or possibly longer, depending on the practice standards. But there is a pre-procedure check-in and evaluation, getting the IV and all that mm-hmm. set up. And then there is the procedure, and then there's also at least 20 or 30 minutes of recovery time.
Mm-hmm. And then what is the post-recovery course? Can they go back to work? They can't drive? What are some of the discharge instructions you have?
Yeah, so it definitely requires taking it easy the rest of the day if mm-hmm. The sedation is used. I actually didn't mention the procedure can be done without any sedation mostly a patient preference that they do want to work that day mm-hmm. or they do want to drive that day. If they have a mindset that it may feel some discomfort that's going to be temporary, kind of a gas type pain or cramping, that they're going to get through it, they really can be done without mm-hmm. sedation. In other countries, they're done much more commonly without without sedation. But for the vast majority of the people, it will be no driving, no working, no major life decisions, no alcohol, that sort of thing the rest of the day. But generally speaking, if everything went smoothly, they should be able to eat right away. Most people are hungry after the procedure mm-hmm. because they've been fasting mm-hmm. either with the clear liquid diet the day before and then
can they generally jump right in?
Nothing to eat that day of the procedure up until the procedure. Mm-hmm. But there's no specific
diet
restrictions. Mm-hmm. I just tell patients to kind of eat whatever they feel up to.
Okay.
They may not want to, you know, eat a big steak dinner.
Don't
right
go to
afterwards,
crystals. But, yeah, right. Take it easy on yourself.
Yeah, but most people will feel pretty normal within the next couple of hours, but they still have those restrictions about not being able to drive, et cetera, because the medicine is still going to be in their system. The following day, after they go to sleep that night, wake up the next morning, they should be back to normal. They can resume all their normal activities, go back to work and all that
okay,
stuff.
Okay, one procedural question I had was, do you introduce gas? Like, are people going to have those sharp pains when they get up, like some like laparoscopies or something like that when you do the procedure, or not really?
It depends. Gas, or it's just actually air is introduced through the colonoscope uh-huh. to expand the colon in order to get the best look. If it's collapsed, there's a lot of folds. It's very difficult to see. So air is introduced. And generally, we do try to take it out as we take the camera back. Almost everyone will have to pass some gas during the recovery time. But usually by the end of that 20 or 30-minute recovery period, if they've passed enough gas, they shouldn't feel too much gas or bloating. But occasionally people do for the next couple of hours until they really pass out all the rest of the gas.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about risks? Are there risks with the procedure?
There are risks, yes, with any procedure. This particular procedure has some more common risks that we discuss. One is the risk of the sedation itself, and that generally involves effect on the vital signs, either the patient's ability to breathe and get enough oxygen. It can affect the pulse or blood pressure. Those things are all monitored during the test. Those all can be reversed with additional agents or just stopping the medication. The other main risks that we talk about are injuring the lining of the colon during the time of the procedure, either just with introducing the camera itself or with the instruments that we use to remove polyps, especially the large polyps I talked about. Those generally include bleeding from a polyp site, especially if the patient was on aspirin or blood thinners beforehand that would need to be addressed.
Do you stitch up there or cauterize up there? If you had to take a polyp out, how do you close that wound in there?
Yeah, if it's a large polyp, cautery can be used at the time of that the polyp is removed, and that generally does a good job at preventing bleeding, though there are some there's a small chance of delayed bleeding in those cases. Small polyps usually are removed without any cautery or other intervention, and just kind of like pulling off a hangnail, you may see a drop or two of blood, and that will clot normally and not have any problems for the most part.
Do you have to do any pre-procedure blood work?
Most patients, no.
Okay.
But they do have to review with their doctor what kind of medicines they're on, if they, especially if they're on blood thinners.
Like Coumadin
or even Plavix or even aspirin or other anti-inflammatories can affect the
So would they have to stop their medicine so many days before the procedure?
Again, it's individualized and it's all balancing the risks of stopping those medicines if they're required because of heart conditions, et cetera. They may need to be continued and just accept that slight additional risk of bleeding during the procedure. Or they may, if the medicines are used for a lower risk condition and they can be safely stopped, generally they're stopped a week or so before the test. And then depending on the findings and how many polyps or large polyps are removed, they can be resumed shortly after the test is complete.
What about perforation? Is that one of the risks?
Yes, that's another risk that we talk about. And like I mentioned at the beginning, one of the barriers when people have heard stories, usually that's the story that they've heard. Perforation means poking or tearing a hole in the colon, and that will introduce air throughout the abdomen. And in almost all cases, would need to be fixed by an additional surgery, going to the operating room with a general or colorectal surgeon, and either fixing the injured part of the colon or removing the injured part of the colon. Definitely, that's a feared concern.
But how much of a risk is that in terms of percentage?
It's very small. Overall, nationwide, the risks are quoted at about 1 in 1,000. So it is very small, but it does happen. And even in the best hands, it can theoretically still happen, which is maybe why someone has heard a friend of a friend happen. So we think that it is a very small risk and would need to be discussed and factored into the decision about whether to have a colonoscopy or not. Especially someone that does have other medical conditions or is starting to get at an advanced age where the risks of the procedure may actually outweigh the benefits. But for the general 50-year-old that we're talking about that may have about a 5% lifetime risk of developing colon cancer without screening, that's about a 1 in 20 risk versus potentially a 1 in 1,000 risk of having a complication.
So far outweighs the screening risk. Very good. Let's talk about virtual colonoscopy. I know people, we talked at the very top of the show about a lot of people may not get it done because it's more invasive. Mm-hmm. And so with new imaging techniques, I know a lot of patients out there are Googling and trying to see what can be done. We see these heart-lung scans. We see virtual colonoscopy. Tell us about that and what your opinion is about that.
Okay. So colon cancer screening as a phenomenon does actually have options, including colonoscopy, which we've been talking more about. But there are other approved methods, including testing the stool for blood yearly, a limited exam called a sigmoidoscopy or barium enema, mm-hmm. which is an X-ray test that look at the colon that can find large polyps. If one of those tests are positive, then a colonoscopy would be required to actually remove the polyp or further investigate it. And yes, in the last several years, virtual colonoscopy, which is also known as CT colonography, is a type of CAT scan using special software that can format the images that the radiologist looks at to actually make it look like a colonoscopy, mm-hmm. and see polyps. Again, those would need to be removed with an actual what we call optical colonoscopy. But as the technology improves, those tests are getting very, very accurate, the virtual colonoscopies. And it may be the right test for a particular patient. Generally, as gastroenterologists, we just encourage patients to get screened in some form of or another. The virtual colonoscopy, though, does have its limitations. One is that at this time, most insurance companies do not cover it as a primary screening test.
Do you think that will change in the future with more experience with the imaging?
It may.
Hard to tell.
Sort of remains to be seen. We would just encourage patients to get screened. And again, if a polyp is found, we remove it. So as long as a well-studied, accurate screening test mm-hmm. is being done, that's really the primary goal. As far as the virtual colonoscopy right now, it still requires the preparation to clean mm-hmm. the colon out of stool, which, again, for most people actually is the worst part of the whole mm-hmm. Process. It does not involve what we might call the invasive part, inserting mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. colonoscope or the camera into the rectum, but it actually does involve inserting a tube into the rectum to inflate the colon.
So the cameras can get a clear picture.
So that the CAT scanner can, get a clear picture of what's going on. It does involve some radiation exposure, which mm-hmm. is relatively low, but, can theoretically add up and have its own risks over the years. Since the CAT scanner virtual colonoscopy can detect small and flat polyps as well, they generally recommend a 5-year follow-up for a normal virtual colonoscopy. So theoretically, starting at age 50, going for the next 20 or 30 years, there may be several scans done and radiation exposure at that mm-hmm. time. And then the other part of it is finding something on the CAT scan part of it that's not expected in another part of the abdomen besides the colon. And that may be a very good thing if an incidental mm-hmm. cancer of some other organ is identified. Also may be a negative if an artifactual abnormality shows mm-hmm. up that requires more testing and other biopsies for mm-hmm. something that turns out to be benign or,
So you might end up with double tests.
Correct. Yeah. So that's just, again, another individual decision, especially if a patient is on the blood thinners like we talked about.
There might be a candidate.
Really would be a high risk.
Or sensitive to anesthesia or some other indication.
Correct.
Okay.
With the kind of caveat in mind that, if a polyp is found, they would need to be a candidate for some additional testing to remove the polyp or have surgery for a cancer if mm-hmm. something like that was found. So, mm-hmm. again, an individual discussion with your doctor, but mm-hmm. theoretically among the options for colon cancer
A new
cancer
possibility,
screening.
But might be appropriate for a handful of patients.
Correct.
Some patients
yeah.
that might be indicated.
Or maybe living in areas of the country where there may not be the access to standard traditional colonoscopy that there are in metropolitan areas like we live in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, well, believe it or not, we're kind of coming to the end of the show. I think we've covered most of why we take the test, what the standards are, and the follow-up, and the risks, and how it goes. But I know that the patients will remember stories, and so I always ask the guests, Are there any patients that come to mind that you thought of that were reluctant to have it, or you were able to really get a clear picture, or that just are memorable?
Yeah, I mean, I think the patients that stand out to me are ones that just come in for the average, you know, routine test, and most of the time they still will not have cancer, but sometimes we do find a large polyp that certainly, if it were left alone, mm-hmm. it almost definitely would have turned into a cancer that would have probably mm-hmm. resulted in, at the very least, additional chemotherapy and surgery and potentially result in the death of this person. And by coming in and removing mm-hmm. that polyp,
save their life.
Yeah, and occasionally we have found even large polyps that have a very early forms of cancer in them, and having those removed, even if there's clear margins on the polyp stalk, which we sometimes see, that may be all the treatment that they need for that very early cancer.
You know, that brings up a question we didn't talk about was, if you do have to send something out, how long does it take to get results back? Or on most of these tests, can you give the results to the patients when they wake up?
Well, we can give the results of what we found, and mm-hmm. we can say you had 3 small to large polyps. The pathology report is the final answer to that, and that may take a week or two, depending on the infrastructure of where the polyp needs to be sent and looked at by the pathologist. Sometimes it's even shorter. It just really depends on the process that's in place and what the strategy is for getting back to the patient after the polyp result mm-hmm. is available.
Okay, so we always think it's not us. That's the message you're telling me, is you go ahead and have the screening. You hope it's not you, but every now and then you know what it is.
Correct.
And it may have saved your life.
Exactly.
Yeah, very good. Well, I do want to hear a little bit about your practice and where you are and how patients can reach you. So tell us a little bit about Metro Atlanta Gastro.
So we're a small group of gastroenterologists. There's 5 outpatient gastroenterologists like myself and 1 hospital-based physician. We are on the campus of St. Joseph's Hospital. It's called Emory St. Joseph's now, right across the street in the Doctor's Center. And we're easily available to be reached through our office number at 404-255-4333 or our website at metroatlantagastro.com.
Mm-hmm. And do you have an endoscopy center?
We do.
In your practice, so
yes.
They don't have to go to the hospital. You
Correct.
Have your own, and
yes,
you all operate in there and do your procedures.
We
in
do
there.
The vast majority of our procedures in our endoscopy center.
Okay, Correct. And I've been there, and it's beautiful. You would think you were in a hospital to all you listeners out there, so nothing to be afraid of. It's a very convenient thing when you have your doctor and their facility right next to each other. I think we're to the end of the show. Anything else you want to comment on about demystifying colonoscopies?
I think that's about it. We did talk about the lifetime risk for any individual about getting diagnosed with colon cancer in their lifetime. And if you add up the population of the United States, in 2013, it was estimated that 143,000 people were diagnosed with colon or rectal cancer, which we kind of lumped mm-hmm. together. Because of increased advances in treatment, et cetera, there's about estimated over 1 million people living with colon cancer in the United States. Like you said, it's the third most common cancer in men and women, and actually the second leading cause of cancer death. So,
yeah. And one of the big messages today is because it is typically more slower growing, it is a lot of times preventable.
Correct.
If you have your screening. So if we get nothing out about what we talked about today, please get in. You heard the baselines. If there's indications or high risk factors, 45 should be your starting point. For most
40,
Americans,
40. Yeah.
For most Americans, probably get your baseline at 50.
Correct.
So please get in, check yourself out, and stay safe. And thanks for joining us today. Please log on to our sponsor's website at www.healthgate.com to see what savings there are might be for you. And I think actually you'll be putting up some offers on HealthGate yourself.
Well, hopefully by mid-February.
Yeah, we'll for colonoscopy. Offers. So no excuse not to get in. And have a great day, Atlanta. Warm up. Thanks for joining us. Bye.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.